Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. In a result garnering national attention, Westchester County Executive George Latimer came out on top in the Democratic primary for New York's 16th Congressional District Tuesday, unseating Congressman Jamal Bowman after a fiery campaign. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Have a great party! Party on!
The former state legislator and term-limited county executive beat Bowman with roughly 58% of the vote, according to unofficial results from the State Board of Elections. In front of a watch party of about 500 supporters in White Plains, Latimer called for unity and civility going forward, casting himself as a moderate candidate who can heal partisan divides in Washington.
There are good men and women in Washington who feel the same way we do, and we have to find each other and link with each other. We have to look at the arguments of the far right and the far left and say, you cannot destroy this country with your rhetoric and your arguments.
The bitter, high-profile primary put fractures in the Democratic Party on full display. Bowman, who was part of a larger group of progressive House Democrats called the Squad, lost the nomination for a third term despite endorsements and rallies over the weekend with big names like Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Both campaigns spent a total of more than $24 million on ads, making it the most expensive House primary on record, according to Ad Impact.
I don't stand with Benjamin Netanyahu. I stand with the hostage families.
Scott, we call for the hostages to be returned multiple times.
You have to make it part of the deal.
Let's listen to our question from Scott Dubin.
The defining issue of the race was the war in Gaza, where more than 37,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli military strikes ever since the terrorist organization Hamas killed roughly 1,100 Israeli citizens on October 7th. Bowman has repeatedly called for a ceasefire and roiled voters in his heavily Jewish district by accusing Israel of genocide and dismissing claims that Hamas committed sexual violence as, quote, propaganda. Here's Bowman at a debate hosted by the League of Women Voters earlier this month.
We need a permanent ceasefire right now, and we need food to get into Gaza today. Our taxpayer dollars are going towards supporting a famine. This is unacceptable.
On the flip side, Latimer's campaign received at least $14 million in funding raised by the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Bowman and others repeatedly accused Latimer of bending to AIPAC, as well as racism over the course of the campaign, claims Latimer has denied. Bowman, meanwhile, has repeatedly denied allegations of anti-Semitism. Speaking with reporters Tuesday night, Latimer maintained his stance on the Israel-Hamas war lines up with that of the majority of the Democratic Party. He says he supports a two-state solution in the Middle East, but not an immediate ceasefire, arguing Hamas can't be at the table when both sides come together to negotiate a peaceful way forward. Asked if he felt AIPAC was critical for his win, Latimer downplayed the endorsement slightly.
Any successful campaign has lots of different components that work. That was one of them, and it wasn't the only one.
Tuesday's watch party was heavily attended by members of the local Jewish community and labor unions, like the Transport Workers Union. Carlos Bernabel, division chair representing Westchester County's Beeline Bus Service for TWU Local 100, says he supports Latimer for the help he gave bus workers during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Latimer is very good to us. He did the right thing, you know, supporting us with the stuff that we need. You know, keeping the buses cleaning and keeping us safe.
Scarsdale resident Karen Kosowski, meanwhile, says she feels Latimer is a unifying figure.
It feels great to know that the candidate who wants to unify people and represent all his constituents won. He deserved it and he won, and I'm just really thrilled about it.
Let's give it up for George Latimer!
The 16th District, which includes Westchester County and part of the Bronx, is considered by some to be a Democratic stronghold. Latimer will face Republican Miriam Flitzer, a pediatrician and former mayor of Scarsdale, in November. Bowman will still be on the ballot on the Working Families Party line. In a defiant concession speech, Bowman said the fight is just beginning.
We should be outraged when a super PAC of dark money can spend $20 million to brainwash people into believing something that isn't true. We should be outraged about that.
Latimer's victory is just the latest entry in a charmed political career. Now 70, the county executive reflected on his start on the Rye City Council nearly four decades ago before stops on the County Board of Legislators, State Assembly, and State Senate. In other unofficial results across the Hudson Valley, Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha defeated former legislative staffer Gabby Madden to win the Democratic nomination in New York's 103rd District. Democratic Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett defeated Columbia County Supervisor Claire Cousin in the 106th District. And Assemblymember Mary Jane Shimsky turned back a challenge from her predecessor, Tom Avenatti, in the Democratic primary for New York's 92nd District. Reporting from White Plains, I'm Jesse King.
Two Hudson Valley State Assembly members held onto their ballot line Tuesday, and some newcomers are advancing to the November contest. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard with this roundup.
First-term Democratic Assembly member Sarah Hanna Shrestha will advance to the general election after turning away a challenge from Gabby Madden. According to unofficial returns, Shrestha took two-thirds of the vote in the 103rd District, which includes parts of Ulster and Dutchess counties. Shrestha said the election shows the area wants a progressive representative.
They want to make things winnable in a state where we have a Democratic supermajority. We don't want to settle for crumbs. We really want to push the whole state forward.
Shrestha will face Republican Jack Hayes in November. The first-term lawmaker says she wants to continue to work to pass legislation to reduce plastic packaging, approve medical aid in dying, and create green social housing. Shrestha is also co-leading an effort to create a public authority to replace Utility Central Hudson. In the neighboring 106th Assembly District, which includes parts of Columbia and Dutchess counties, longtime Democratic incumbent Dee Dee Barrett won by a 15-point margin. She defeated Progressive Working Families Party-endorsed challenger Claire Cousin, a Columbia County supervisor. Barrett said across a district with 26 municipalities, her willingness to listen to voters and small business owners sets her apart.
I am really about bringing our communities together rather than the divisiveness that we're just seeing way too often right now in the political arena.
Barrett says she will continue to work to address housing affordability, support the environment, and assist farmers with workforce needs. In a statement, Cousin congratulated Barrett and credited the primary with raising issues that pushed Barrett to co-sponsor legislation in Albany for housing vouchers, elder parole, and the Climate Change Superfund Act, a bill passed earlier this month that awaits Governor Kathy Hochul's signature. "We did that," said Cousin. Barrett will face Republican candidate Stephen Krakauer in November. In the 107th District, which includes parts of Albany, Columbia, Rensselaer, and Washington counties, Working Families Party-endorsed Democrat Chloe Pierce defeated fellow newcomer Kent Sopras to challenge first-term Republican Scott Bendett. Pierce says her campaign brought her to all four counties, which helped connect her with voters across the district over issues like affordability.
The fact that I am a younger woman, I think, was a benefit too. Especially with reproductive freedoms on the line, and thankfully we have the ERA back on the ballot, but seeing what happens at the federal level, I think people were really excited and energized to see a younger female Democratic candidate running to represent them.
The Democratic primary contest in the 102nd district does not have a clear winner, with only 85 votes separating candidates Janet Tweed and Mary Finneran, according to unofficial returns. The 102nd district includes Schoharie and Greene counties and parts of Albany, Delaware, Otsego, and Ulster counties. The assembly seat is currently occupied by Republican Chris Tague.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gostino. This week, I sat down with State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. I asked Tom about the financial situation at the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, after the governor suspended indefinitely the congestion pricing plan, which would charge drivers entering Manhattan below 60th Street, and this week's vote by the MTA board to indefinitely pause the plan. Here's DiNapoli.
Well, I think of my dear friend, our former Lieutenant Governor Dick Ravitch, who led the MTA, and he always, whenever we talked about funding for public transit in New York, always said, you have to keep the system in good repair. You can't let it deteriorate and go back to the bad old days of decades ago, and you need reliable funding sources. So, you know, I've often been asked prior to, you know, the scenario you just described, you know, how do I feel about congestion pricing? And I always said, look, it is a policy choice that the state of New York has made, right? It's actually a law that enabled it. So I have neither a pro or a con, a personal opinion. It doesn't matter what a personal opinion may be. The MTA's funding, particularly its capital plan that keeps the system in a state of good repair, allows for expansion, enhanced safety, and so on. The funding for that capital plan is contingent upon this money, the $15 billion that you alluded to. So if you don't want to have congestion pricing, and people can have that opinion, what are you going to come up with as the substitute revenue source? And that's my concern with where we're at right now. You know, whether the governor was right or wrong to put a pause on that, you know, that was her choice to do it. But again, because of the timing and how quickly it happened, obviously the legislature was in no position to deal with filling that hole. So the MTA board, as you know, has met, and they've indicated that they have to, you know, essentially reprioritize their capital spending. And the report we put out before that MTA board meeting really tried to point out very clearly that there aren't any good options for the MTA if the money is not there. They're going to have to put a priority on, you know, basic maintenance and try to keep the system in good repair. But some of the improvements on, you know, for example, accessibility to make the system more ADA compliant for people with disabilities, many of those initiatives are going to have to be put on hold for now. Signal modernization, what really has an impact on safety and the quality of the timing of the trains, put on hold. Second Avenue subway expansion, something that goes back to the 1970s in terms of planning, on hold. And, you know, other kinds of initiatives that have been in the plan, you know, just they're just going to be on an indefinite hold. So the governor has said, as you know, that her commitment is to keep the MTA well-funded and not to have these projects be totally eliminated. But, you know, the big question still is, where's the money going to come from? How much will be there? So in the short run, a lot of very important initiatives are on hold, and the capital plan is going to be significantly reduced. You don't want to go back, again, echoing Dick Ravitch, you don't want to go back to a system in poor repair, because we're not back to 100% of ridership because of the pandemic, and the MTA is so dependent on you know, fares and ridership. So if the system starts falling backward on state of its condition and state of good repair, we could see those numbers going in the wrong direction. So a lot of concern. We'll see where it goes, but we've really got to come up with the money to plug this very significant hole in the capital plan funding.
State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, two questions. One, if it doesn't come from these plans I mentioned to fill the hole, you know, you mentioned it doesn't matter what my personal opinion is, but where do you see that money as the chief financial officer for the state? Where should that money come from? Should it come from a tax? Should it come from a congestion pricing plan? Should it come out of the general fund?
I think the likelihood of finding money with existing revenue streams probably is not the answer. You know, it's very easy if people say, oh, the MTA spends so much money, and we've certainly had audits that have said they could be smarter and more efficient on a whole host of areas. But when it comes to the capital plan, you really need a reliable long-term funding stream. And keep in mind the strategy behind the congestion pricing was that for the money that was going to come in, they would then be able to bond over a longer term. That's how you got that $15 billion figure. But it would be backed up by a very clear revenue source, meaning the money that would come from, you know, from this tolling.
That's State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, a Democrat. ¶¶ listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gostino. New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed legislation that will regulate how children use social media. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Hochul championed the legislation, making it her number one priority in the final days of the legislative session.
Today, we save our children. We have heard their cries for help, reminding us as adults that we have a moral responsibility to protect young New Yorkers from harm.
The measures make it illegal for big tech companies to use algorithms on the social media feeds of children under the age of 18 and prohibit social media companies from overnight push notifications unless parents consent to the practice. The second law bans the companies from collecting and selling children's personal data without parental permission. Studies have shown that increased use of social media among young people is linked to higher incidence of depression, anxiety, and even suicide. Meanwhile, a new poll by Siena College finds that New Yorkers overwhelmingly agree with the new laws. But Siena pollster Steve Greenberg says those views do not translate into increased support for Hochul among potential voters.
They're the worst they've ever been. Right now, 38% of voters view Kathy Hochul favorably. 49% view her unfavorably, underwater by 11 points. It's the largest she's ever been underwater since she's been governor.
Greenberg says just 44% approve of the job that Hochul is doing in office, compared to 50% who don't. Those scores are also the lowest she's had since becoming governor nearly 3 years ago. Greenberg says independents are shifting away from Democrats and leaning more toward Republicans. And he says there's a general sense of unease and dissatisfaction on other issues like crime, the influx of migrants into the state, inflation, and the future of democracy. And he says more than half of New Yorkers think the state and the country are headed in the wrong direction. That translates into lack of confidence in the person who's leading the state.
They're concerned about a lot of issues, but right now, more than anything, they're cranky, and they don't feel that their needs are being addressed.
Democratic President Joe Biden in blue New York is leading his Republican opponent, former President Donald Trump, by just 8 points. Biden won against Trump in New York by over 20 points 4 years ago. Hochul's opponents pounced on the numbers. The New York Conservative Party said in a statement that the poll shows Hochul is a failed governor and that change needs to be made at the White House. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
With the legislative session in the rearview mirror, New York State Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie continued his statewide tour this week in Lake Placid, visiting the Olympic venues in the village. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there and filed this report.
The state has invested over $500 million over the past 7 years to upgrade the Olympic venues, including the bobsled and luge tracks, ski jumps, and speed skating rink. Olympic Center General Manager Chad Cassidy started the Democratic Speaker's tour at Miracle Plaza, which also hosts the refurbished Olympic Center Museum.
It's great to have you here. Appreciate you taking the time to come today. This is Miracle Plaza here. This was built starting back in 2019. We just completed it a couple years ago. Thanks to the funds from the state to come in here and kind of rejuvenate all of our venues. Got the scoreboard from the Miracle on Ice game in 1980.
Oh, that's that.
Game over here. That's it. That's the actual panel.
After taking a few selfies in front of the Miracle on Ice scoreboard, Cassidy then led Hastie upstairs, where the speaker took a virtual ride down the bobsled track.
Buckle up, you're going to be going pretty fast here in a second. There would be two people in this slide. You'd have a brake man in the back and a driver up front. There's two person and four person.
And how fast would I be going?
Around probably 65 to 75 miles an hour, somewhere there. There you go, hit the brakes. It's a good run.
Hastie then jumped off the ski jump, virtually.
You're going to put your feet right up here, hold on both sides, and look right through there. You're going to see what it's like to go off the jumps.
Now this is just the practice, right?
That's the actual hill, yeah.
But it would have snow on it, right?
Oh yeah. It doesn't have to all the time, but it...
So I've done two things.
We can probably arrange for you to give it a try for real.
A few steps away, Hasty was enthralled watching the video of the 1980 Miracle on Ice game.
The greatest moments in sports.
Yeah.
Watch them right here.
Where's the hockey rink?
Right beside us.
Yeah, we're going to go in.
Assemblyman D. Billy Jones of the 115th District led Hasty into the Herb Brooks Arena, named after the famed coach who led the Miracle team and the site of the iconic game, and viewed the outdoor Olympic skating rink before touring the Mount Van Hovenberg sliding venues. Hasty says the tour brought back memories.
Coming here now, it's like it's a little surreal. You get that, you know, proud nostalgia builds up in you. You're just inside the hockey rink, watch the video of the Miracle on Ice. The great assemblyman, Billy Jones, just wanted me to come and see what the state's investment over the years to refurbish this classic place. From what I understand, it could allow for the Olympics to return. So I think it was well worth the investment. It looks beautiful.
Olympic Regional Development Authority President and CEO Ashley Walden says having the speaker and other stakeholders visit gives them a better sense of the impact of the state investment in venues.
A large focus of the investments were in the preparations for the World University Games. So the Olympic Center, the Olympic Oval, Mount Van Hovenberg, the Olympic ski jumps, those received quite a bit of the investment in the capital projects. But in addition to that, we operate three ski mountains, Bel Air, Gore, and Whiteface. Those also were part of the capital project to continue to upgrade so that we can keep up with the evolving climate change and also make sure that we're providing excellent guest experiences and economic impact to the regions we operate.
During his visit, Speaker Hasty also announced a $250,000 grant to the Lake Placid Food Pantry and Thrift Shop. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gostino. A Capital Region music venue, which is world famous for its acoustics, will undergo a major expansion. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons filed this report.
The Troy Savings Bank Music Hall will soon be home to the Capital Region Music Hub. The space will feature classrooms and teaching spaces, a new recording studio, and an event space that can hold up to 175 people. The new space, housed below the historic music hall, will keep some of its notable furnishings by incorporating pieces of the bank, such as material once a part of the former teller line. The renovations will preserve the hall's famous acoustics. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall Corporation Executive Director John Elbaum says the renovations will honor the venue's history.
The hall has many surprises that they've been offering up to us. We're working with the State Office of Historic Preservation to ensure that we preserve this beautiful historic property. That's very important to us. But at the same time, we have to bring it into the modern age.
Elbaum, who has been with the hall since 2011, says the $14.5 million state and private investment will keep the city's downtown vibrant and provide opportunities for underserved communities to participate in the arts.
One of the key things that we've been focusing on for the last few years is our educational outreach. So we're working with the local schools as well as Boys and Girls Club, YWCA, and Troy Housing Authority to help bring people who haven't had the opportunity to experience things in this music hall. And we have a whole roster of teaching artists that we've been working with over the last few years going out into the schools. So this will give us a place to do those both within our own building but also in the schools.
The nearly century and a half old creative space will also see HVAC upgrades, expanding its season beyond its current October through mid-May schedule and making the space safer for artists, patrons, and volunteers. Already this year, the venue has hosted 50,000 people, with annual totals expected to exceed 70,000. Mayor Carmela Mantello says expanding its operations builds on her efforts to make Troy more accessible for residents and tourists. Mantello says the city is also working with other community organizations and nonprofits on cultural equity.
The Historical Society, the Public Library, the Troy Public Library, ARPA monies have gone into not just our parks, but many of our nonprofits. And, you know, many of those nonprofits need that leverage. So even if we're, you know, a small partner to a large partner, the beauty is they're partnering the ARPA monies and using them as leverage toward, you know, federal, state, and local and private other dollars.
Daniel J. Hogarty Jr. is the retired president and CEO of the former Troy Savings Bank. The bank, which moved to its 2nd Street location in 1870, has been vacant for more than a decade. Speakers at Tuesday's announcement credited Hogarty with keeping the music hall alive. Hogarty says when the bank moved to a public company in the late 1900s, he was concerned that potential buyers wouldn't preserve the venue.
So what I did was I created this building into two condominium units. One was the music hall, which we put into a foundation, and the other was the bank condominium. And then we created actually a third foundation, which we used some of the proceeds from the public offering, known as the Troy Savings Bank Charitable Foundation, to provide the funds to support the musical.
Hogarty says the foundation has provided nearly $15 million in funding to preserve the hall since 1994. Renovations are expected to begin this summer and be finished by the end of 2025. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2426 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.